Hi, I'm Chris Berube. Today on Focus, we'll be joined by Mark Gerchik. He's the author of the new book, Full Upright and Locked Position, Not-So-Comfortable Truths About Air Travel Today. Gerchik is the former chief counsel to the Federal Aviation Administration and has consulted with dozens of airlines and airports across the country, so he's exactly the guy to talk to about where all the bodies are buried in the airline industry. He'll tell us about how air travel has gone from glamorous to an uncomfortable experience that nobody looks forward to. And he'll answer all of our questions about whether or not we're safer post-9/11 on planes, why airplane travel is so expensive for some and so cheap for other people, and what pilots are actually doing behind those big heavy doors at the front. You have any questions for Mark Gerchik about planes or air travel? Give us a call or tweet at us today on Focus. That's Mark Gerchik coming up after the news. You're listening to Focus on WYLL AM 580. I'm Chris Berube. Today on the show, we're joined by Mark Gerchik. He's the author of the new book, Full Upright and Locked Position, Not-So-Comfortable Truths About Air Travel Today. Now, if you wanted to know something about the airline industry, Mark Gerchik seems like one of the best positioned people to tell you. He was the chief counsel to the FAA and has consulted with airlines and airports across the country. And in his book, he charts how air travel went from being a luxury that everyone coveted to an uncomfortable, not to be looked forward to situation to be in. Mark Gerchik joins us on the phone from Washington. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Chris?
I'm very well. How are you?
Great.
Thanks for joining us. So when I saw this book, when I saw the subtitle, Not So Comfortable Truths About Air Travel Today, I'm kind of a nervous flyer. So my immediate instinct was, oh, this is going to be about how planes aren't very safe. I was worried it was going to be a whole book about, you know, the ways that the wings could fall off or engines right. could fall out of planes, things like that. But as you write in the book, that's actually not really something that we should be that worried about, the actual safety of the physical plane in the air.
Absolutely. And you know, you're among at least 30 million Americans who do have some anxiety about the safety of flying. In fact, those are just the ones who admit it. Basically, the system is very safe, and that's the least of our concerns, really. There was an excellent analysis done by an MIT professor a number of years ago who calculated that you'd have to fly literally every day for about 63,000 years, maybe a little more than that, in order to be involved in a fatal airline incident. And in fact, you're more likely to become, I think any random kid out there is likely to become president of the United States more than they're likely to be involved in a fatal airline accident. So that is really not a concern. There are safety issues that we need to work on. There are issues about pilot fatigue, and it's a system that is operating at its capacity. But still, the record has been really remarkable. We haven't had a commercial airline crash in nearly 5 years in the United States.
It's interesting that there was a news report recently about the fact that this has been kind of an not historically long period without an accident on the airlines, but it seems like it's been a long time since we've had a fatal accident. Why has that been? Is it just that planes are safer now than ever before, or is it that we're just going through a really lucky period in history?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it really does have to do with the improving technology. Safety technology gets better all the time, and even airplane safety technology. There are new devices that have basically eliminated whole types of what used to be serious risks, monitors that tell the pilot when they're approaching what they call ground proximity monitors, if they're getting anywhere near an obstacle, a mountain, or something of that nature. There are a new kind of aircraft device called a TCAS, a collision avoidance system, that lets pilots know when they're approaching or when they're intersecting with another aircraft and gives them advanced information and tells them what they should do to avoid that. So that's another area that we haven't had any problems with. The technology really has improved tremendously, and I think also the fact is that there is good safety regulation in this country, and pilots are very well trained. So we really have been, I think, more than lucky. I think this is programmatic, which isn't to say that you can't, that something might not happen, because when things do occasionally happen, and usually, though, there are a confluence of very, very unlikely events occurring at just the wrong moment and a whole series of things happening. So safety is really something that I think Americans certainly can be very confident in, air safety.
It's interesting. I think this might be an urban legend, but something that I feel like nervous flyers are told all the time is that your biggest risk in a plane is on takeoff and landing. Like that is the time when there's most likely to be some kind of an incident with an airplane. Is that true, or is that just kind of a commonly repeated misunderstanding?
Well, there are lots of – actually, if you look at the statistics about when incidents have occurred, they do occur more on takeoff and landing than when the airplane is just cruising at altitude. And that's not unexpected. That's when you're at a lower altitude. There are more aircraft in the area. The aircraft is itself operating in ways that are, you know, require more stress on the aircraft and the engines. So that's probably the case. On the other hand, really, given the statistics and given the real scientific facts here are that your chance of being involved in a safety problem on an airplane are just very, very low.
You're listening to WYLL. This is Focus. Our guest is Mark Gerchick. And if you have a question about the airline industry, give us a call at 217-333-9455 or tweet at us at Focus580. And we actually have a caller. Steve from Kankakee is on the line. Steve, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting topic. I had just an overall observation and then a quick question for your guest. I'm in my late 50s and I used to fly quite a bit, and I can remember prior to 9/11, you know, if you got to the airport early, they would actually say, well, you're too early for your flight, but if you run, you can catch this flight over here, and, you know, I'd be running through airports, which, of course, that's not going to happen anymore. We have two young children. 10 years ago, we took them to the obligatory vacation in Florida. I can tell you it was an absolute miserable experience going through the airport with two children taking shoes off. And what have you. And then just going back again to the 60s, I remember my relatives flying and, you know, real china and silverware and champagne, and it was all very glamorous, and of course we can say goodbye to it forever to those days. But recently Nova ran a special, I think it was in New Jersey, where there was a horrific plane crash, but it was a smaller plane. It was like a prop plane. And I think it flew into a house, and the focus of the piece was, I think, lack of training, the low pay, and the general fatigue of the pilots, who were very young, and they seem to be holding the lion's share of accidents these days. And I was just wondering if your guest had any comment on any or all of that. And I'll listen off air. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
Sure. I think the caller is referring to the incident was in Buffalo, New York, probably about 4.5 years ago, and it did involve a regional commuter aircraft. And actually, the caller is also correct that it also involved fatigue and some questions about the training and experience of the crew. One of the first officer, a co-pilot, had commuted to her job, I believe, out of Newark, where the flight originated. She had commuted all the way across the country and apparently wasn't feeling well, and it had crashed on the couch at the in the pilot's room there in Newark. And real issues were raised about, you know, are we doing the right thing here, particularly with regional airline safety. And so the FAA, the DOT, actually, Department of Transportation, which is the parent agency of the FAA, has proposed a fairly comprehensive new rule on pilot rest and duty time, in which they're trying to get at this issue of ensuring adequate rest for pilots, and that is likely to come into effect. Although there has been some opposition from the industry on cost issues, so that's an important issue and one that is a high priority in terms of things we do need to continue to do, particularly these regional airlines. The other issue about, boy, running through airports, I remember that too. It was you used to be able to get there 5 minutes before the flight and run on. Well, those days, as the caller indicates, are completely over. You know, this issue the caller mentions about getting to a flight a little earlier and can you get on the earlier flight rather than the later flight, and that opens up a whole new issue about airline fees. You usually can't take the earlier flight, even if you're standing there, without paying a change fee to take that earlier flight, and that's something that irks a lot of passengers.
Well, there's a lot to pick over in that comment, so let's actually start with this issue of fees. It seems like air travel is a lot more accessible than it has ever been. More people have access to it, especially because of some of these small regional carriers who are undercutting each other and the competition is driving the price down. But a lot of people are surprised to find that you could be slapped with, you know, $20 fees for putting your bag in an overhead compartment now. It seems like the airlines are really nickel and diming people, as you call it in the book. When did that trend start, and why has that become an important source of revenue for airlines?
It really started in 2008, although there had been some indications of it by some smaller carriers in 2007. 2008 was really the year that that this whole issue really reared its head. Basically, it was in response to a huge uptick in fuel costs. That year, I think, fuel costs rose about 50%, but they actually quadrupled in the 4 years leading up to 2008. So, and fuel is the single most expensive cost for an airline to operate. So, basically, the airlines were being slammed, and they were really panicking. They were trying to financially. They were against the wall. Bankruptcies were imminent. They were facing the almost 40% of their costs were now going to fuel. And they were looking to improve their, A, cut costs, and, B, get more revenue. And somebody decided, well, here's a great idea. Why don't we take that quaint idea of a flight and kind of deconstruct it and monetize every little piece of it that we can? And that's what they did. So we started with fees. The first fees, I think, were second bag fees. And if you wanted to bring two bags on your trip, you basically pay for the second bag. That quickly morphed into charging everybody for checking any bags. And by the fall of 2008, pretty much the entire industry had gotten into the bag fee issue. So bag fees became endemic. Naturally, revenue-seeking airlines try to figure out, okay, where can we get revenues from other kinds of fees? What else can we charge for? And that's where we have, you know, literally, it's just a panoply of fees now. We started with food, of course. Food actually was there was no food really on airplanes, very limited after 2001, but they started to charge for food. Then we had pillows and blankets. Then we had, as you say, we've gotten to the point now where we're charging, three airlines are actually charging to put your own carry-on bag in the overhead bin, which I think is driving people a little bit crazy at this point. But there are many other fees, you know, to reserve a seat, to talk to somebody on the telephone, to make a reservation. Everything is a fee. So they're not going to. This is not going to stop. Airlines basically are going to charge fees because they're the difference between profit and loss in many cases, and that. So they are going to, I believe, remain for the foreseeable future.
I guess the paradox that confuses a lot of people is that airlines make so much money off, you know, the real high roller customers, the people who are willing to pay, you know, $10,000 for a transatlantic flight where they get a sleeping pod and a shower and that kind of thing. They make so much money off of those luxury flyers. Why is it so important then to, you know, get $20 off some guy so that he can use the bathroom on an airplane?
Well, there are many more of those guys than there are luxury flyers up in the front end. So I think just as a matter of volume, probably $20 from it's actually about $20 to $23 on average that passengers are paying for domestic tickets for just bag and change fees. We're talking about 750 million flyers in the United States every year, and the very, very great proportion of those folks are not sitting up front in the pods and taking showers on their way to across the ocean.
So I'd like to talk a bit about discount airlines, and specifically you talk about regional carriers and people like Southwest and JetBlue who have kind of come to not dominate the industry but have really carved out a big place for themselves in the industry. Even though, you know, the cost of flying with these fees has gone up so much, at the same time these smaller airlines are making it so that it's very accessible to a lot of people, and they really are driving each other's prices down through competition. Why are they able to charge so little in some cases to let people fly?
Well, let me start with this. Overall, the airline industry will tell you they're still a bargain. Basically, if you look at prices, airfares 20 years ago or maybe even 10 years ago, they're pretty stable. They haven't gone up, and they may have gone down depending on how you're calculating it, even including fees. So while airfares have gone up fairly significantly in the last 4 years, and while we're adding in these fees all the time, if you look at the longer term, it's probably fair to say that since the deregulation of the airlines in 1978, fares are still pretty low. But that said, you're right. The huge competitive effect on fares has come from these a lot of what we call the low cost carriers, and it's not really regional carriers so much as the low cost carriers like Southwest, which used to even be something called the Southwest effect. If Southwest comes into a market, fares are going to drop. In fact, even if they talk about going to a market, fares are going to drop. You're right. JetBlue and others have adopted a different approach. So their pricing, their fare pricing is really not that different from the major airline pricing now. Southwest used to undercut everybody. It doesn't really anymore. Sometimes it does. But there is a sense that they're simpler. The consumer sees the pricing as more transparent. And they do tend to be a little less involved on the with the charging, you know, escalating fees. Southwest, for example, and JetBlue also have I believe that you get a free bag on JetBlue and two free bags on Southwest. So, and they seem a little more simple. So I think they have been having a competitive influence on the industry, a dramatic one over the years, and they are the choice of they've now become the carrier of choice for about 1 in 3 Americans. So that's a huge increase from where it used to be just 10 years ago.
It's funny, I'm Canadian, and I often fly with this discount Canadian airline, which is very much modeled after something like JetBlue. And
WestJet?
WestJet, and sometimes I'll fly with Porter Airlines, which is like a newer one. And whenever I manage to get a discount ticket with them, they're constantly, you know, putting on half-price sales. I'm always wondering, like, are they watering down the tank? Like, what are they doing to make this, like, viable for them?
Well, they're probably looking for market share, and they may be willing to take a little bit of a hit on revenues in order to get you as a loyal customer or get you to try their airline as opposed to the big airline. And there is a competitive aspect to this business. It's there really can be. No, they're not watering down the
oh, I know.
Fuel.
And that,
I know.
But, I should say that is a joke. I'm not trying to libel any of Canada's great airlines.
Of course. All of the airlines in Canada and the United States are very heavily regulated, carefully regulated for safety. And so nothing like that's going to be allowed to happen. But, yes, I mean, the approach of the U.S. airlines also has been, was until about 2008, to try to lower prices to capture market share. If you could grow and capture market share, that was the object, even if you were losing money. And 2008 and the fuel issue scared everybody. They basically scared the industry into saying, look, we can't, that game isn't going to work over the long term. We need to try to profit from each passenger. So we need to cut costs, and including particularly fuel costs, and we need to raise revenues. On the cost side, of course, there was tremendous effort and tremendous focus on cutting fuel costs. And there are all kinds of things were done to cut fuel costs, primarily to cut weight. The amount of weight that you carry on an airplane dictates how much fuel gets burned.
You're listening to Focus here on WYLL AM 580. Our guest is Mark Gerchick. His new book is Full Upright and Locked Position, Not So Comfortable Truths About Air Travel Today. And Mr. Gerchick's background is that he has been a counsel for the FAA, and he's consulted airlines and airports across the country. If you have a question about the airline industry, anything you've ever been, you know, burning to know about, give us a call at 217-333-9455 or tweet at us at Focus580. And we've been talking about trying to get, you know, cheap tickets, trying to get discount tickets. There's so many rumors about, you know, when is the best time to buy an airline ticket. I guess there's one persistent one that Monday at noon is kind of the best time because that's when all the ticket prices reset. Is there any truth to that?
Well, actually, I've heard there are several airfare gurus out there, of which I must say I'm not one, who track this stuff obsessively. And I know Rick Cini is one who says it's Tuesday at 3 p.m. on the theory that that fares tend to be put into effect lower, that fare sales go into effect on Monday mornings, and by the time it moves through the whole system of airfares and marketing and so forth, that Tuesday at 3 p.m. is a good time. I really don't know if that's the case. There has been some studies done indicating that purchasing a ticket, this is on average, about 6 weeks out from your flight is tends to be a period in which the fares go down 4 or 5%. So that's another possibility. You know, my sense is, though, that the airlines have a tremendous, tremendously sophisticated capability to price their tickets, and trying to outfox that is pretty tough. And it may not even be worth it. If you're, by the time you say $15, you've spent, you know, 20 hours trying to do it, and it kind of may not matter. But the way fares are set is based on historical trends for flights like the one you want to take, and when they sold out, and what the demand was 3 weeks out, 4 weeks out, 3 days out. How many tickets were left unsold, and how many people they expect to run up at the last minute with their, you know, corporate gold cards and say, I'm going to pay full fare. So it's a very, very complicated process that the airlines use, and remarkably accurate. The goal for them is, of course, to fill every single seat at the highest possible fare.
You raise an interesting a very interesting point in the book, this idea of buckets, and that when you're on a plane, there's this perception that, you know, somebody else is getting a cheaper plane ticket than I am. And in many cases, that is true. Like, not everyone is paying a uniform fee to be on the plane. And that's not just because of first class. Like, lots of people in coach are paying more or less than you are probably to be on that plane. Why is there such a wide variety of fees that people are paying to be on the same flight?
Well, the idea that the airline idea is really that each of those different each of those seats is not really the same product. It's a different product. One of those seats may look the same and may feel the same, may have the same amount of legroom. We're all sitting in coach, but one of those seats has been held out by the airline for the last minute flyer who's going to be willing to pay full fare to get on that airplane, and they want to hold that seat, and so that flyer is going to pay more money. He's going to pay the airline more money to save that seat for him or her, and until the last minute. On the other hand, there are plenty of seats that the airline knows that they're going to have to sell to vacationers who are willing to buy that seat 60 days in advance, willing to forgo any refunds if they miss the flight, willing maybe to stay over a Saturday night. That's a different product in the airline's view, and they're willing to sell that product for much less because they're sure that seat's going to be filled once it's purchased. So you're right. The physically similar seat is really a different product for maybe there may be a dozen different fare levels charged on any particular flight just in coach.
We have another caller on the line, Mike from Urbana. Good morning, Mike.
Hi. My question might be a little bit off topic here, but my son has expressed interest in piloting as a profession. He's currently in high school. And so I'm wondering what you can tell us about the future of piloting as a profession for somebody that would just be getting into the industry now.
Thank you, Mike.
That's a good question. The pilots today, the most senior pilots, will tell you that it's not the profession it used to be. Back in the day, being a professional pilot on a commercial airline pilot was a very prestigious and higher paying profession than it is now. Through the series of bankruptcies and various other financial problems that happened to the airlines, the salaries have gone down. They're still solid, but they've gone down. Currently, though, we're running into a point where there seems to be a need for a new wave of pilots to come into the industry. As some of the folks retire, we have an age 65 limit for airline pilots required by the FAA, and so there is a view that we are, as things pick up, and as the and particularly international airlines as well pick up, that there will be a higher demand for airline pilots. So I think that You know, I think that we're in a kind of a dynamic situation where the demand may increase. The big salaries may not be where they were. They have declined and over time. And then there's the issue of it takes quite a while to move from an entry-level pilot, often on a regional airline, a first officer usually, all the way up the ranks to a very senior person at a major airline. Pilots have, in order to become a commercial airline pilot now, you have to have 1,500 hours of experience, and that takes a lot, and it's expensive, and you've got a high burden of education at the get-go. So it's kind of a mixed bag is what I'd say, but pilots will tell you they love their jobs almost uniformly, and there seems to be something special about it.
It seems like pilots, especially on these kind of smaller airlines where they make maybe, I don't know, is it fair to say $40,000 a year? It's sort of in the lower...
At the very lowest, the first officers, the co-pilot, in essence, at the entry level can make as little as $20,000 a year.
Wow, geez. Is it fair to say that these are also the people who are being overworked? So it seems like when you're breaking in, that's when you're kind of stuck both with the lowest pay and also the most burden on you physically.
They're working hard. They're working very hard, particularly because they're flying into more congested airports very often, and they're making multiple takeoffs and landings a day. Whereas, you know, let's say your most senior major airline pilot is taking off from Chicago and landing in Hong Kong, and that's it. You know? I mean, not to say that that's easy, because they've got their work too, and they've got a huge responsibility with 300 people in that airplane. But on the other hand, yes, it is a tough job, I'm told, for the regional pilots.
Well, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll have more questions from Mark Gerchick about his remarkable new book, Full Upright and Locked Position, and some uncomfortable, possibly upsetting, horrifying truths about the airline industry today. You're listening to Focus on WYLL AM 580. You're listening to WYLL AM 580. This is Focus. I'm Chris Berube. And today we are interviewing Mark Gerchick about his new book, Full Upright and Locked Position, Not So Comfortable Truths About Air Travel Today. Mr. Gerchick was the former chief counsel of the Federal Aviation Administration and has consulted with airlines and airports across the country. The book looks at some really uncomfortable things about the airline and explains a lot of the unexplainable things about how planes fly in the modern age. And we're taking your calls. If you have any questions about the airline industry, about plane travel, anything you've always wanted to know, give us a call at 217-333-9455 or tweet at us at Focus580. So, Mark, earlier in the show, we heard from Steve from Kankakee. He called in, and one of the things he talked about was how, you know, way back in this golden age of flying, you used to get, you know, fine china, you used to get all of these amenities that are no longer available. Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, it seems like today it's not even that you don't get those amenities, it's that you get literally as little as is legally possible from the airline when you're actually on the plane.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the CEO of a major airline, I think it was United, recently said, look, our job is to get you where you're going on time, safely, with your underwear. And I think that's the view of what the airlines view that to be their mission. It is not going to be a happy adventure anymore. It is not going to be something most people look forward to, at least in coach. But it has become basic transportation, essentially what they used to call no frills. I have to say that as to the golden age of air travel was probably not quite as golden as we like to remember it. At least way back, aircraft were not what they are today. They were not pressurized to the same degree, and so they would have to fly through more turbulence. And it was, technologically not as sophisticated. And, also we were paying more then. The cost of a flight of flying was made it relatively inaccessible to lots and lots of people. Today, something like half the adult population in the United States has flown or more. And so that's... It has become much more accessible. We can get where we want to go. So there is a balance to be had here. On the other hand, as you say, service has really been cut back. Anything that costs anything has either been cut back or has been made optional, essentially, something you can pay for if you want it. and that includes legroom, which as a person who's 6'3", makes a big difference to me.
It's interesting that they have these ads. If you fly with one of the bigger airlines like American, they'll have these ads now that say, we're constantly innovating. Look at these incredible new things that we're developing right now. And they'll show like the newest sleep pod that they're developing. And, you know, they'll say, yeah, we're giving you twice as much legroom as before. And it seems like these innovations have all happened for people who are willing to pay a lot more to fly, you know, first class or business class.
Yeah.
Is it possible that we'll see? Yeah. Is it possible we'll see those innovations come to coach, or is that something that's kind of more about the fact that we are seeing more stratification than ever in our plane travel?
Well, I think you're correct that the economic analysis, the economics of the situation incentivize the airlines to put more money and to invest more in the front end, because that's where the passengers are either paying more for their tickets, a lot more, or where they're generating more revenue, or where they're more frequently frequent flyers. So that is where the money's going. A lot of the money is going. There was a whole issue that over the years has been investment in lie flat beds, whether the beds are really lie flat or whether they're angled lie flat. some airlines have put showers in the in their first ultra first class cabin. So now the question though is, okay, what about for the rest of us? And I have to say the technology of the airplanes is improving, and I believe it will have some of it is really going to be helpful to consumers, to regular customers. New airplanes like the 787 and the Airbus 350 are going to have more humidity in the cabin, and that's something that really, if you've flown a lot, you know that sort of Death Valley dryness that you get. That's going to be improved somewhat by these airplanes because they're made out of composites that can handle more moisture in the cabin. The new airplanes will also be pressurized to a lower virtual altitude, which means it will feel like we're sitting at a lower altitude rather than at 8,000 feet, which is the current norm. It'll be more like 5,000 or 6,000 feet, which will make a difference in the sort of breathing easier in a sense. And so that will improve. We're not going to be getting gourmet meals, though, and we may not be getting any more smiles from the flight attendants, but there will be technology that does suggest some improvements.
You talk about humidity from human sweat on the planes.
Yeah.
Is there any – you write in the book that there's really no other kind of humidity, that once you're in a plane, it's basically this hermetic environment, and any humidity is coming from other people. I have to say, when I was reading that, I became – uncomfortable. Like, I felt claustrophobic just reading that fact.
Well, you know, humidity is there have been efforts to add humidification to airplanes. But the problem is that humidity requires water, and water means weight, and weight means expending fuel, and that costs money. So you can't haul around lots of water to maintain a pleasantly humid environment in the cabin. That said, they are the high-end business jets do have humidifiers, and there have been experiments in trying to humidify some of the cabins. Some first-class cabins on some aircraft, I think they're now looking at humidifying to a higher level. But some experiments have been done. There were issues about whether you can add water into the system without creating other problems with the whole ventilation system and corrosion and other things like that. So the air, though, at those altitudes just doesn't contain much water, and the exterior air. And so when it comes into the airplane, it doesn't either. So, yes, it's most of the humidity on an airplane is a product of everybody's breathing and everything else.
You're listening to Focus here on WILL AM 580. Our guest today is Mark Gerchick. His book is Full Upright and Locked Position, Not So Comfortable Truths About Air Travel Today. And if you have any questions about air travel or about the airline industry, 217-333-9455 or tweet at us at Focus580. So we talk about kind of that issue of comfort on the plane, and people make the observation all the time that it seems like there's less legroom than ever before. And you say that's actually true.
It is true. Basically, kind of 10, 20 years ago, really, it was the distance between the back of one seat to the back of another seat was generally in the range of 34 inches. We're talking about in coach now on the typical airplane. Now it's on average more about 31 inches. So that's kind of a 10% decline, and that's a rough estimate. There are a couple of airlines like Spirit, I believe, and some others, which have now taken it down to what I call the limit of anatomical possibility, about 28 inches, and that's very tight. In fact, they don't have reclining seats. They call them pre-reclined seats. And so, you know, we are being packed in more. You can understand the economics of it. If you took 1 inch away from the seat, the leg room on every row on a 30-row airplane, you've got enough extra room to put in a whole new row of seats that with paying customers in them. So there's an incentive for the airlines to you know, cram as many people as they reasonably can aboard. There are also efforts to narrow the cushioning on seats to get another inch of leg room from that, and some other efforts that are being made. But, you know, the economics of an airplane dictate you get as many people as you can in there. In fact, there are even plans now to design aircraft lavatories to be smaller, if that's possible.
I can't imagine.
Well, that's true. There, I believe it's Delta is going to be talking about smaller lavatories on their 737s, 737-900s, that would allow them to put an additional 4 seats in the airplane. It's hard to imagine. It is hard to imagine. But they say they can do it without causing a problem for passengers.
In terms of making the size of the actual washroom smaller, it seems like the big cost in terms of space from a bathroom is just what you do with all the waste, right? It's not so much the size of the bathroom itself. It's the size of the compartment to hold all of the stuff that people are producing.
Well, no, actually, most of the waste actually goes in a vacuum system that goes into a tank elsewhere in the airplane. So,
right.
So that's probably it is more or less the dimensions, which are now, of course, only 3x3 about. So it's hard to imagine them getting much smaller. I would add that also it's not just a matter of the leg room. It's also the fact that you can pretty much forget about having an empty middle seat anymore. Load factors, that is what they call the percentage of seats that are filled on the airplane, have now really gone to record levels. Planes are much more crowded than they were, just in terms of numbers of passengers. We're now talking about probably on average in the mid 80%, 80-85% of is the typical annual average load factor now for many U.S. airlines. And in summer months, when you've got a big travel season, we're talking about 90%, which, as a technical matter, means on most flights between major markets at convenient times, there isn't an empty seat. And so we feel more, we feel more crammed in there.
In terms of the empty seat issue, it seems like those middle seats traditionally were for children, right? Like, it seems like those middle seats were not really designed for additional human adults to be put in them.
Well, they are the same width generally as the other seats, but you're right. Kids did tend to go, and then, which is one reason that I'm cautioned in the book. We talk a little bit about germs and contact and so forth in the book, but you got to be careful about thrusting your hands in the middle seat pocket there. That's where the kids' diapers tend to end up and so forth. So,
I've always wondered about that. The seat pocket in the front. You know, when a plane taxis, it doesn't really have that much time before they load another group of passengers on there. So I'm guessing they don't, disinfect or clean that whole seat pocket between flights, right?
Well, between flights, they probably do try to get what's in the seat pockets out of there if they have time. But you're right, the turn times can be as little as a half an hour, sometimes even a little less than that. And the emphasis is to get that plane turned around as quickly as possible. Southwest is an example, an expert in this. There's a kind of a choreography they have where if you can cut about 8 or 9 minutes per flight of turn time, you can get another flight up that day with the same airplane, which is a very, very expensive asset. So in terms of cleaning, there's a very limited cleaning that can occur as they turn the airplane. They probably are trying to get the stuff out of the seat backs and the trash and so forth. But no, they're not going to be disinfecting things in that 25-minute turn time. They will clean the airplane every night to some extent, and every 30 days or so, in general, the industry has a really a deep cleaning of the airplane. This is an improvement from the dark days of 2008 when it could go on well longer than that between major cleaning.
We have a caller. Tony from Champaign is calling in about germs in airplanes. Tony, welcome to Focus.
Yeah, I was just wondering, I actually had a couple questions. One is a passenger cabin a good place to spread airborne germs?
The deal with this is really pretty simple. If you're sitting next to somebody who's sneezing, you're going to get it. And we're in a very, very, it's a tight, volume space. Basically, an airplane cabin is probably about as little volume of air space per person as anything, any public place, except maybe a rush hour elevator. So we're tight in there, and that's an issue. As to the air system, the air ventilation system, they do exchange the air on airplanes very frequently. And they use HEPA filters, which are these hospital-type filters, for recirculated air, which constitutes about half the air on the plane. The rest of it comes in from outside. So there is a fairly high degree of ventilation. The problem is you just have so many people in such a confined space that it's the person-to-person communication. It's also the contact issue. If everybody touches that, as I mentioned, that little knob on the lavatory door that locks and unlocks it, that's an issue. I'm a big fan of hand sanitizer if you're interested in the solution.
If I could ask another question, I don't know if you talked about this earlier, but the thing about birds in the engines, I was wondering how many can go in and the thing still fly? And if it is sensitive to solid objects, how come it doesn't have an issue with hail, sleet, or snow? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you, Tony.
That's a fair point. Bird strikes are an increasing concern, and they are a concern. Lots of airports are located. Some airports are located in areas where there are lots of bird nesting near water areas. They were originally set up there probably for noise and other reasons. And so birds have become a significant problem. You'll remember the famous bird situation with the aircraft, the U.S. Airways aircraft that had to land in the Hudson River a number of years ago after ingesting birds in both of the engines. There is a lot of effort the airports are undertaking to try to get a handle on this thing by basically getting rid of birds and other wildlife, but bird strikes have increased. Typically, almost any aircraft, commercial aircraft, jet aircraft, is going to be able to take off and land with a lost engine. And the pilots practice this a lot in simulators and so forth, that basically one engine out of the two is sufficient. And so it's a very, very rare instance where you have an ingestion of birds in both engines of an aircraft. So that's what happened in that Hudson River case. Beyond that, it's a fair point. When a bird goes into an engine, it comes out of the other end of something as what the scientists call snarge. Believe it or not, that's actually the word.
Oh God!
And the snarch comes out the other side. Hail and I really don't have enough knowledge of the technology of the inside of the aircraft to tell you about hail and so forth. But I would imagine that these are very, very powerful metals that are used in these engines, and I think it's the bulk of the body of the bird that's the problem compared to a hail type situation.
You actually alluded to something there that really surprised me. So the miracle in the Hudson situation, that's actually because birds got into both of the engines of the plane?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Oh,
they were ingested in both, and they stopped the engines. I have to say there's another great story about that particular event, and it goes to the issue of I have a chapter about pilots, and about these guys are pretty professional and very impressive. The pilot, Chesley Sullenberger, was 17 seconds from hitting the water with his co-pilot, and you can hear the tape. And he says to the guy, 17 seconds from about to crash into the Hudson River, and he says, got any ideas? the co-pilot turns to him and says, actually not. And that's the last thing you hear. It was great. They're very cool characters.
Well, we have another email coming in. This is Betsy, who writes, I have flown frequently lately, and it seems that on each plane, three per trip, there have been an equipment problem ranging from the black box not working to a fuel gauge not working. Why is this happening? Are they not keeping up with maintenance to save money, or is it something else?
You'd really have to know a little bit more about, you know, what the airline was and what the circumstances were. The fact is that they have to. There's all kinds of maintenance sign-offs that have to occur before a flight. So in a way, it should be a little bit reassuring that that they're not operating anything with an essential part of the aircraft inoperative. An interesting point that folks don't know is that airplanes can operate safely and by the rules while a number of components of the airplane are not operative or not working right. You don't have to have certain equipment on the airplane operating in order for it to be allowed to take off. There's something called a minimum equipment list that the airplane has to go by. The maintenance is very, very carefully regulated in terms of broken instruments and so forth. So I'd have to know a little bit more about the particular facts to have a good answer for you on that one.
You're listening to WYLL. My guest is Mark Gerchick, and we're in our last few minutes here. I'm wondering, we've talked about how airlines have had to cut costs, but also, you know, raise all of these fees just to make ends meet. I'm wondering, is there a way to make the airline industry viable in a way that is not going to hurt consumers? I mean, would it involve, you know, fewer flights? Would it involve less competition between the airlines? Is there something like that that could make a difference?
Well, some people have suggested that what we really need to do is re-regulate the whole airline industry and basically have government tell, you know, the airlines that you have to have 34 inches between seats and you have to, you know, provide food and you have to include bags. The problem is that would inevitably raise prices. And fares, as I say, overall have been a relative bargain. So it's a trade-off, and really this kind of comes to the nub of the issue. How much are we willing to sacrifice in terms of a pleasant experience in air travel in favor of a relatively cheap experience, access for everybody to get where they're going? And I think it kind of comes down to that issue. My sense is that where we are now and where we're likely to be for the foreseeable future is air travel is not going to be a comfortable, happy experience for most folks in the coach seats. But the history has been that people are willing to suffer a lot in order to save money to get where they're going safely. So I guess that's where I see the status quo sort of ending up.
So you don't see either a radical change in price in the next few years or a radical change in comfort that we're experiencing?
I don't. I think that there's some hope for some improvement in comfort basically because of technology, but there is no economic incentive to make flying a much more comfortable experience. It just isn't going to work that way. And the airlines are now really in a position of saying, look, we're businesses. We need to make profits. We want to make profits anyway for our investors. We're not making a lot, and they aren't. The profit margins are pretty limited, even though they're doing a lot better than they have been. They're saying, look, you get what you pay for. Forget about sit back and relax. You get what you pay for.
So why is it so hard to actually make consumer regulations around the airline industry? I mean, there have been all these attempts to do it, and it's just never really worked out. What's kind of the big hurdle to changing the regulations that would make it a better experience? Yeah,
you're right, Chris. Making new rules is difficult. There are really two areas here. On safety rules, it's not difficult. The FAA has a lot of emergency powers to make safety regulation and to ground airplanes, and as we've seen, and to order immediate inspections. And that happens without any real objection. On the consumer side, though, we're talking about consumer regulations. there can be, it's very much business as, you know, Washington business as usual. There are very powerful forces involved in consumer regulations on all sides, including the industry, which really often doesn't want consumer regulation that's being proposed. It took 11 years for the government to get put in effect a rule that said that if you're stranded on the tarmac of an airport for more than 3 hours, you get to get off the airplane. And that it took 11 years to get what many people think is sort of a common sense rule there. That said, the government has, particularly the Obama administration, has been fairly aggressive on, in certain areas on regulations. You have to, the airline now has to be clear about what the total cost of your airfare is, of your airfare, including taxes and mandatory fees. There was a lot of fighting about that one, but it, for many people, that's a common sense kind of regulation. And there are other regulations that the Department of Transportation has been able to push forward on the consumer side in the last few years.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Mark Gerchick, you seem like you were the perfect person to write this book, and I'm really glad that you did it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Mark Gerchick is the author of the new book, Full Upright and Locked Position, Not-So-Comfortable Truths About Air Travel Today. You can find it online. We'll have a link to it on our website, will.illinois.edu. Thank you so much for listening, and please join us again tomorrow here on Focus on WILL. I'm Chris Berube. The producer of the show is Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft was our technical direction today. You can find past episodes of Focus online at will.illinois.edu, and make sure to join us again every day here on AM 580 WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. Thanks a lot for listening. We'll talk to you again next time.